Major support for Louisiana Eats on WWNO provided by Zatarain's, proud producers of authentic New Orleans-style cuisine. Zatarain's, a New Orleans tradition since 1889.
From WWNO New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. Big Bad Chef John Kearns is a native New Orleanian who's made a name for himself in Oxford, Mississippi with his multiple restaurants. John joins us to talk about his recently published irreverent Southern cookbook, Pickles, Pigs, and Whiskey. Then author Adrian Miller discusses the superstitious history of black-eyed peas and other overlooked stories of popular soul food dishes. And we visit Baton Rouge to speak with Reverend Raymond Jetson about the significant ways the Red Stick Mobile Market is changing his community. We're eating well and doing good on this week's Louisiana Eats. If you are a fan of shrimp and grits, then you owe a big thank you to Hop and John Martin Taylor. 20 years ago, Hop and John's Low Country Cooking introduced the world to recipes and ruminations from Charleston and the Carolina Coastal Plain. Hop and John, welcome to Louisiana Eats.
Poppy, it's so great to be back in New Orleans. You know I love it here, and it's always a pleasure to be in your company.
Well, let's go back to the very beginning. What inspired you to actually write this book in the first place?
Well, I interviewed Karen Hess on the history of Thanksgiving. And Karen Hess, you know, many of your listeners may not know, but she's basically the grandmother of culinary history. Shortly before interviewing her, I was vacationing in Newport, Rhode Island, where Charlestonians had vacationed for 300 years. And there was a big pile of the belongings, it looked like, of someone's attic on the sidewalk. And on top of this pile of trash, calling my name, was a handmade book with a hand-sewn cover with actual photographs of plantations glued in there. And on the title page, it said, Old Receipts from O. St. John's. Well, I knew that it was St. John's, Berkeley County, South Carolina, a few miles down the road from where I grew up. And so I took the book and I showed it to Karen Hess, and she helped me very specifically date it. And so for the next 7-8 years, I dove into plantation journals and market records and printed cookbooks. So that's how it began.
Back in that time in Charleston, what was the general culinary condition like?
When I opened my store in 1986, as far as restaurants go, there were a couple of French places, there were a couple of Italian places, there was the place we called the Greasy Greek, and there were a couple of self-proclaimed soul food houses that sold maybe red rice and fried fish, but there was no urban farmers market. There were none of these dozens and dozens and dozens and dozens of restaurants that you now read about in Condé Nast Traveler, for example. It was basically a culinary backwater.
So in essence then, you sort of helped Charlestonians discover or rediscover their own food.
Yes, I did. There was an alternative newspaper, a monthly newspaper in Charleston, and I had a column in it. And basically, the book, which came out in 1992, basically the book was a collection of expanded articles of mine that I tried out on the public. I also, when I got back to Charleston, I couldn't find stone ground, whole grain, grits, or cornmeal anywhere. Oh, that's not quite true. You could maybe find a bag on the shelf of a natural food store, health food store, whatever you want to call it. No milling date, sitting out, not refrigerated, and whole grains go bad quickly, especially in hot and humid Charleston and New Orleans. So I set out on a mission to find someone growing the right type of corn, grinding it the right way, letting it dry in the field, Processing the right way, grinding it between stones, not adding anything to or taking anything away from it. And I visited 30 mills throughout Appalachia trying to find someone doing it right. And I found this young couple who had just left desk jobs in Atlanta, and they had restored an old mill, and they were growing the corn themselves at the time. They had about 7 acres. And grinding it right, and it was the right kind of corn treated the right way, and so I started selling grits.
So these grits, they tasted like the grits of your
childhood.
They taste
like, I love when, yes, it's the traditional corn, it's dent corn, and there are several kinds. There's flint corn, because it's very, very hard,
yes.
And dent corn, the kernel has a dent in the top of it. They sort of look like teeth, and I started selling them in my shop and writing about it. I profiled my millers in the New York Times. I wrote about it in Gourmet. Gradually, chefs and restaurateurs started buying grits and putting them on their menu in Charleston. And by the time the book came out, 6 years after I opened the store, I had grits customers in all 50 states, many of whom are restaurateurs and or chefs, few of whom are actually in the South, and almost none of whom are actually Southerners. So of that, I'm most proud, really. There wasn't a single restaurant serving shrimp and grits in Charleston when I moved home in 86. And
that's
you dare not have it on your menu now.
So I guess that it's all your fault that I constantly have to explain to people today that shrimp and grits is not Creole food.
Well, it is Creole food, but it's Creole with a small C. It's not Louisiana Creole, because, you know, Creole means a mashup. and Charleston had a Creole cuisine develop, you know, it was founded 50 years before New Orleans. By 1750, almost all of the people, both black and white, who lived in Charleston had first lived in the West Indies. So we did have a Creole culture and a Creole cooking. It's just not Louisiana Creole with a capital C. So,
well, from where you sit, what do you think the most amazing thing is as you look at the changes that have been affected by this work that you did over 20 years ago?
I really don't think that I affected the changes. I think that I'm part. I can see this.
You're the agent of change.
Well, I see this sweeping arc, really. But I really think it begins much farther back. I think it began in the 1960s when Fritz Hollings was a very forward-looking governor, was elected governor, and he saw the state suffering from poverty, and he did many things to help the tourist industry. With Fritz, the interstate highway system came, so all these people could get there, and air conditioning came. So there's your beginning. And then the 80s came, and this great, you know, economic boom of the 80s, however it may have been based on fake ideas, I mean, it's like, but it came, and there was suddenly all of this money, and people were spending money to go out to eat, and they're coming to town, and restaurants are opening, and so as people started putting shrimp and grits on their menu, then it started spreading throughout the country. So yes, my work is important, I think. I think a university press wouldn't be republishing the book if they didn't think it were important enough to keep the book in print. But I can't take too much credit. I'm not a chef. The first time somebody asked me to hold the sauce, I'd slap them. So, you know.
Well, tell me what is special and different about cooking your grits than what people might be accustomed to.
Well, they are whole grain. Nothing has been taken away from them, and nothing has been added to them. So we haven't degerminated them. And degerminating is a technical term for removing the germ. And the germ is the part up at the top that is also known as the kernel. And it has a hard casing on it that encases the oil. So we don't remove that. It can be removed several ways. It's mostly removed mechanically, but it can be removed by putting grits in a lye bath also. And then they're called hominy grits because it becomes hominy then. So it's not removed. And because it's not removed, that fat is in there, and we all know that fat carries flavor. So to begin with, they're more delicious, but you've got also got to cook them longer because there's more stuff to break down.
Mm-hmm.
So they haven't been broken down. Commercial grits that you buy in the grocery store, they'll last on the shelf forever, but they taste like the packaging they're packed in.
Yeah,
they taste like cardboard, and there's no oil there, and there's not much of anything. Furthermore, because of the steel rollers they've been ground between, the steel rollers heat up, and they've actually been cooked a little bit. I like to cook them in the crock pot. Overnight, you put it on low, 4 parts water to 1 part grits. A little bit of salt. Always salt your grits in the beginning because mm-hmm. if you don't, it's really hard to salt grits afterwards. And I just let them go overnight, and they're usually perfect. Interestingly, when I cook grits, I only use water and salt. And when people taste them, they can't believe it. I've had chefs here in New Orleans taste them and say, I can't believe there's not butter, milk, or cream in there. And I treat grits as one would treat rice or pasta. I want it to be the starch. I want it to taste like corn. I want it to taste like what it is. And then you can put anything you want to in the sauce. Yeah, I don't put butter in my grits or cream or milk in my grits, but I may have 3 sticks in the sauce, so, you know.
Well, and as opposed to that steel rolling method of making the grits, describe what stone grinding really is.
We have 2 blue granite stones. Actually, we have lots of them because my millers are fanatical artisans. And you have 2 stones, and they are going in opposite directions in the mill, and you put the corn between the stones. Unlike 90% of the millers in the country, we do not bolt our products. Bolting is a type of sifting. And most people will sell you what they call whole grain grits, and then they will sift out the smaller particles and sell that as corn flour, what you call fish fry here in Louisiana, or corn meal. We don't do that. My millers are such perfectionists that for the corn flour, we put the stones almost touching, and we grind it very finely. Everything goes in the bag. For the cornmeal, we pull the stones apart a little bit and grind. We have a medium grind. Everything goes in the bag. Same thing with the grits. Pull the stones a little bit farther apart. Everything goes in the bag. Most cornmeals and corn flours you buy, even if they say they're stone ground whole grain, they aren't really whole grain. And the reason they're not whole grain is because they've been bolted. And back to the germ, it's the hardest part of the corn. And those little flecks, those hard flecks that you see in there, they're harder to grind. And so you're getting only the other part, the starchy part, and not the parts with all the flavor.
Well, you mentioned fish fry, and I would be remiss letting you get out of here without having a word about deep fat frying, because I understand that's another passion of yours.
I wrote a book called The Fearless Frying Cookbook. Yes, it is. You know, frying is, it always cracks me up when you start talking about frying, because people will say these truly uninformed things, such as, oh, I can't eat those French fries because I've got a problem with my cholesterol. No, wait a second. Okay, you've got a problem with cholesterol. Never mind that they've never proved that ingested cholesterol has a thing to do with serum cholesterol. If you're really worried about your cholesterol, you better choose your grandparents. I mean, it's the truth. It's the truth. And so I'm thinking, okay, you can't eat my fries. Peanut oil doesn't have any cholesterol, so what's the deal? Frying has a bad rap. It's a mess to fry, but you know what? Cooking is messing. They're potato peels. They're, you know, there's banana skins. There's, you know, there, you throw away a lot of stuff. It's a mess. If you think about it, deep frying is actually a dry cooking method.
Mm-hmm.
Water boils at 212 degrees. I fry almost everything in peanut oil because it's very stable and it has a very high flash point. That is a point where it will burst into flames and where it will disintegrate. So I fry almost everything at 365 degrees, which is very easy to remember because of the days of the year. First thing people should do if they want to fry is buy a thermometer. Check it with your boiling water. So you're putting food in 365 degree oil, and you hear, shh. Well, what is that? That is the water in the food being sucked out and immediately vaporized.
Mm-hmm.
So as long as steam is coming out, fat can't go in. So it's really a dry cooking technique. Clean oil, always clean oil. Don't crowd your pot. Constantly maintain the temperature. I think one of the mistakes that many people do is they turn their burner up all the way to the highest setting. It comes up to 365. They say, oh, it's 365. So then they put the food in and they start dropping all the food in, all the pieces of fish. I put one piece of food in at 12 o'clock. I put in the next piece of food at 3 o'clock, going around the circle. I constantly mind, you don't crowd the pot. You take the food out in the order it was put in. You use tongs. You lift the food out of each piece of the food, and you let all the excess grease or oil drip off of the piece that you're frying, and then you put it on wire racks, not down on paper towels or in paper bags where it's just going to reabsorb the grease. Cooking, you have to watch what you're doing. You've got hot oil, you've got boiling water, you've got...
And it's dangerous, but you know the craziest thing? In cooking class, the people who for some reason think the way you test the temperature of oil is to put a drop of water in it. Is that the most frightening thing?
It's absolutely crazy. You can test oil if you don't have a thermometer with a little cube of bread, fresh bread. Basically, it will brown perfectly in about a minute if the oil's at the right temperature. But water's just going to instantly vaporize and splash oil up all over you.
Yeah, well, I hope anybody who has that thought in their head, we've dispelled it.
I certainly hope so.
And I am so grateful that you made the time to come for this visit. Come back and see us.
I sure will.
John Martin Taylor and Hoppin' John's Low Country Cooking.
We'll be right back with author Adrian Miller to talk chicken and waffles and learn the true story behind Red Drink. Stay tuned.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's.
When we sat down with Adrian Miller, lawyer turned soul food scholar, he took us on a historical tour of some of his favorite soul food dishes. We discussed everything from the West African roots of red drink to the European beginnings of mac and cheese. Along the way, we discovered what makes soul food one of our most uniquely American culinary traditions. In your book, for the first time, I got a little explanation about the chicken and waffle phenomena. Tell us what's up with that.
So there's a great creation myth about chicken and waffles. So the story that's usually told is that it starts in Harlem in the jazz age, 1920s and 30s, because the club goers were getting out of the clubs at about 3 in the morning, right? So it's too late for dinner, too early for breakfast. So this enterprising restaurateur named Joseph Wells decides to make a hybrid dish of fried chicken and waffles. And that took place there, and it's been popular ever since. Well, it's a great story, but it's not true. Chicken and waffles actually comes from old Europe and lands in the Pennsylvania countryside thanks to the German immigrants there. So we call them Pennsylvania Dutch, which is imprecise because it's Pennsylvania Deutsch. But they bring a creamed chicken and waffle tradition with them. And so it...
Creamed chicken.
Right. And then it starts...
No maple syrup anywhere.
No maple syrup anywhere. And then it gets to Philadelphia and becomes this elite dish and then makes its way south in elite homes. So by 1800s, you got Thomas Jefferson eating fried chicken on a morning where there's going to be a hunt, or a Sunday morning, or a weekend morning, or anytime they're having guests. And the way to think about fried chicken and waffles is think of it as fried chicken in any kind of hot bread. So if you look at the historical sources, it could be biscuits, it could be pancakes, it could be rolls, or anything like that. Now, fried chicken and waffles goes big time in the 1800s, and it shows up on elite hotel menus You know, we had presidents. McKinley talked about meeting his wife at a chicken and waffle dance. It was big time. Then it falls out of favor in white culture, and then it exists in black subculture for decades, and then it becomes big time again in the 2000s. And I'm trying to figure out why it becomes big again. But look, I think you should try it, because what I do...
Well, tell me how you eat it.
So I eat it separately, right? So I eat the same way I would eat a chicken and a waffle. So I put my butter and syrup on the waffle, put my hot sauce on the chicken, and just have it. You know, I think it's a good thing.
I'll reconsider. I'm kind of a chicken and biscuit girl. So you have a whole chapter on why black-eyed peas are superstitiously considered to be lucky.
Mm-hmm.
What's the deal with that?
Yeah, so that was a fun chapter to check out. So there's no corollary for black-eyed peas necessarily meaning good luck on New Year's Day in West Africa. So it's really an old Europe superstition that African-Americans end up embracing. So a lot of European traditions had this idea that, and it wasn't food necessarily, gets transferred to food, but the idea was that on New Year's Day, you have to have somebody with dark hair and dark eyes be the first one to knock on your door. If that happens, then you would have a good year. And so,
you and I should make some rounds.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you have more hair than I do, so I don't know if bald dudes counted. You have that tradition. And then in West Africa, the cowpeas were often associated with deities. So with certain deities, they were the favorite foods. And so they were often used for blessings for twins or births or other things. So you can see that cowpeas had this specialness. Uh-huh. So now you get to the Americas, and you've got this tradition about the black eyes. And also in West Africa, black-eyed peas were often considered an amulet for good luck because it warded off the evil eye. Yeah. And so you see these things kind of come together. Now, the other part that I didn't talk about in my book, which I wish I explored more, is you have Sephardic Jews from around the world having black-eyed peas on Rosh Hashanah. And some believe that the Talmud, the Babylonian Talmud, says that you are to have black-eyed peas. And so there were early communities of Sephardic Jews in Charleston and Savannah, and there may have been an influence there.
That's fascinating.
I think so, too.
Boy, there's nothing quite as delicious as food history.
Right, huh? Yeah.
In every single way.
Yeah.
Now, you almost left what is considered today to be part of the soul food genre out of your book, Macaroni and Cheese.
Mm-hmm.
So how did it get included, and what was your thought process on all that?
Well, I just thought macaroni and cheese is identifiably Italian, but also I just thought it was so mainstream that it would be hard to make a soul food connection. But so many of my African-American friends just threatened to slap me upside my head that I just could, I caved to peer pressure. So that's why I included it. And I'm glad I did, because I found out a fascinating history of mac and cheese, how it starts as this very elite dish. So in the Middle Ages, European royalty was grubbing on macaroni and cheese.
Now, really?
It wasn't the goopy mess that we love today. It was pretty much just the pasta with Parmesan cheese shavings on it. So it was this rich person's dish, again, for a lot of years.
Probably had some truffles, too.
Probably, right? And then cream and other things start to get added to it. And so it enters African-American cooking because it comes to the big houses of the South, again, as an elite dish. And some credit Thomas Jefferson for spreading this around, but I think it was around before he was on the scene. And so African-Americans were often doing the cooking, and I think that's how it enters into our cuisine. Now, it starts to come down the social ladder because of two things. One, because it was very expensive to get Parmesan cheese and also to get the imported macaroni. So American farmers became very good at growing durum wheat, which is necessary for true macaroni. And then also the American dairy industry got really good at making cheddar cheese, which was an acceptable substitute for Parmesan cheese. So the cheddar cheese that we have today is different from what they were making 200 years ago. And from what cheese experts tell me, old British cheddar was very similar to Parmesan.
Ah.
And so when those two things get cheap, then you start to see the price of macaroni and cheese come down. And so it leaves this elite status and becomes more of a working people's dish. And then, of course, in the 1930s, the advent of the blue box changed everything. So it became a real convenience food.
Yeah. Now, before I read your book, Soul Food, I never realized the importance of what's known as red drinks in a typical soul food meal. What is the red drink, and explain why it's so important?
All right. So you have to understand that in soul food circles, red is a flavor, okay? So the red could be red Kool-Aid. I think red Kool-Aid is the official soul food drink.
Okay.
But it could be fruit punch. It could be strawberry soda. And it just has to be red. So what I found is, just before I even wrote the book, I just noticed in most communal settings, there usually is some kind of red drink. And even in soul food restaurants, there's usually some kind of red drink offered. And I was just wondering, well, what's that about? And so I looked back and I found out that there are several ancestral red drinks that crossed the Atlantic during the slave trade. And they're ones that people have had but probably didn't even know. So one is cola. And I know people saying, what is this dude talking about? Colas are brown. Well, if you turn around the bottle or the can, there's always caramel coloring. So cola nuts, are, the main ones are either white or red. And a red cola nut tea was often used as a means of hospitality. So you welcome someone, you can give them cola nuts and they can just chew them there, mm-hmm. or they can have a red cola tea. And that's very popular. And then also hibiscus tea. So in West Africa, it's called bisop, but there's a hibiscus tea that comes across, lands in Jamaica. And if you've traveled in the Caribbean, you've probably have heard of sorrel, mm-hmm. which is a Christmas time drink. That's that West African flower. Now, it starts to make its way around Latin America and South America, and it starts to be called agua de Jamaica. So if you go to a Mexican restaurant and get agua de Jamaica, you're drinking that West African drink.
That's fascinating.
Yeah. And it's the same formula as Kool-Aid, right? For cola nut teas and for this hibiscus tea. You get some water, you color it red, and sweeten it to taste.
Okay, man. I never thought I'd hear red Kool-Aid lionized quite like that.
Now, I have to say, there is a generational shift happening. Yes. A lot of youngins seem to like purple drink more.
Oh.
And that's distressing to me. I say this in my book. I believe the children are our future, that we should teach them well and let them lead the way, but I'm not sure what red drinks.
That was Adrian Miller, author of the new book Soul Food, The Surprising Story of an American Cuisine, One Plate at a Time. The town of Patouville is home to the oldest sugar plantation in North America, still owned and operated by the original family, M.A. Patou and Sons. Located just across the road from the family sugar refinery is Peter Patou's house, which he luckily inherited from his grandmother. Towards the end of sugaring season, Peter hosts an open house there, serving many of the dishes he remembers from his childhood. Recently, I attended one of Peter's country soirees. On the buffet was a stuffed cabbage dish, the likes of which I had never seen or tasted. It was bigger than a basketball and laden with a cornbread stuffing that included oysters, chicken livers, and lots of vegetable seasoning sautéed in butter. That stuffed cabbage was simply a showstopper. Somehow, Peter had steamed the whole cabbage, then patiently separated the leaves to place the stuffing inside. Trussed more elaborately than a turkey, the whole cabbage was baked to a beautiful brown in the oven of his grandmother's old chamber stove. Wielding a carving knife, guests lopped off big wedges, and most couldn't resist going back for seconds. I persuaded Peter to share his family recipe with me so I could, in turn, share it with you all. So for a copy of Peter's recipe and to get a peek at that incredible stuffed cabbage, visit our website, LouisianaEatsRadio.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and Peter Patou's stuffed cabbage makes for some real Louisiana Eats. No one is more outspoken or irreverent as Big Bad Chef John Currents. In his first book, Pickles, Pigs, and Whiskey, John offers his own tips and techniques on bringing real food back to the table.
There are hidden messages in all this. The message there is that the greatest diet that'll never make the bestseller list is called moderation.
Yeah.
And sacrifice. And to another point, like anticipation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're not going to wait until the height of summer to eat blueberries when they come in season if we want them in January. We're going to eat some nonsense that's been shipped from Chile in a container that takes weeks to get to us and doesn't remotely resemble a blueberry. I'm making a plea in that manifesto for folks to find that joy in cooking at home again. You know, it's become such an ogre with people these days that the joy of it's gotten lost, and everybody sort of goes through the same teeth-gnashing, hand-wringing, you know, spiel about, well, I just don't have time, and it's just such a chore. And there's no greater joy than creating something with a story to it and sharing it with someone. And whether it's meatloaf that your mom used to cook that you loved, or your grandmother's biscuits, or whatever it is, I mean, sharing that sustenance and that story with someone is something that it's getting lost.
Well, that's why I think your food is so unique and so special in so many ways in today's food world, because you cook real food. And not only do you cook real food, but you really tend to eschew trends.
Really, you know, we don't take ourselves too seriously. We're about pleasing people. It's never been about a greater artistic endeavor. It's, you know, I learned from the Brennans that what we do is about simply pleasing people, giving people exactly what they want so they return that butt to that chair as quickly as they can. So to sort of knock the shine off of what most folks might expect from this, you know, fine dining experience, I choose irreverence, and it serves us well. I mean, it's just part of my personality, and I think if you asked my mother, she would say, yes, he has been exactly that way his entire life. And so the challenge to me in writing the book was finding a voice, and I tried for years in vain to sort of follow in the footsteps of John T. and Bill Neal and Frank Stitt and John Edgerton to contribute something to the scholarly conversation about Southern food. And every one of those guys that I just mentioned is brilliant. I, on the other hand, am kind of a dumbass. And it took, you know, a couple glasses of bourbon and years of frustration sitting in my office one night that I finally said, you know, to hell with it. I can't say anything that any one of these guys has not already said. And I'd been told forever, just like, tell stories like you talk. You know, like you write these off-the-cuff emails. You know, they're hilarious. Just write like that. And so I did. And it's a little vulgar, but that's the way
that's
I talk.
You. It's, yeah. Why else do they call you Big Bad Chef? So tell me, from BevNap to Hardback, how long was it in the making?
About just a little over 2 years.
Wow. Good job. Well, I'm going to hand you one of my pet peeves. John, Leon Perrin has been making the original Worcestershire sauce since the early 1800s. So why do you think we have to start making it ourselves? And how are we going to improve on something that is an established classic since the 1830s?
Well, I would say, you know, and this is not to be absurdist, but you could argue the exact same thing about French's yellow mustard. Sometimes there's absolutely no substitute for French's. We just set about years ago identifying things that we like and challenging ourselves to develop something similar to it or as close to it as we possibly could that we could say, hey, we made that. I want to say that my cue for sort of coming to understand these things and wanting to go through this process was inspired by Jamie Shannon. I think I remember shortly before his passing, Jamie aging his homemade Worcestershire and the kitchen at Commander's in little oak barrels. And it really sort of lit a fire for me in understanding what these things were more about. Like, why did I love them so much? And it, you know, it also became sort of a, you know, a processing, exactly why the book is broken up into chapters and technique. There was a running joke around our house as a kid that was always interesting at Christmas to my mom and dad, how long I would play with the toy before I then, you know, would sit there and stare at it and then get a butter knife out and start taking it apart to see how it worked. And that was just my, you know, my childhood in a nutshell. And I think it sort of it defines me a little bit. I'm fascinated with how things work.
Okay, so I'll buy this but now I understand that really all you're trying to do is get your readers to think outside the box, cook outside the box, and maybe have an adventure that they might not normally have. Okay. Out of everything, what are you most proud of in this weighty tome that is your first book?
No, that maybe that, that picture of my beautiful bride and the other one of my little naked baby that are in the very front of it. I couldn't be more proud of either one of those. But I think I am I'm saddled, or I should say, you know, for my whole life, you know, one of the most debilitating things that, that I've had to deal with is, you know, is some pretty serious self-loathing. And so through the process of writing this book, I remember thinking back to a conversation that I had with one of my roommates in college about writing a book, and that when you write a book, that's in ink, and that first edition goes to the Library of Congress, and it's there for all eternity. It's for my grandchildren, great-grandchildren, great-great-grandchildren can go and check Pickles, Pigs, and Whiskey out and go. That was my, you know, my old man that, that wrote that. So it's a very permanent thing. And my fear is, you know, as a self-loathing Catholic, was that, you know, I'd get done with this thing and just hate it. You know, I'd looked at it so much or had enough self-doubt that, you know, it was something that I couldn't hang my hat on. And I love the book. I mean, not in a, you know, self-congratulatory way, but I love it because it speaks to exactly who I am.
That was Big Bad Chef John Kearns, author of the new book, Pickles, Pigs, and Whiskey. When you're deep frying food, what's the biggest problem getting things crispy and delicious? Could be the temperature of your oil. When we come back from the next short break, we'll answer that question and more. Stay tuned. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Rouse's Markets. This week's culinary quiz, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute, is all about oil. What is the correct temperature of oil for successful deep frying? The answer? Usually 365 degrees. And remember, when the food is added to the fryer, the temperature will drop slightly. So keep an eye on that frying thermometer and only use that oil once. The quality of your fried product diminishes with each use. Life is too short to reuse old oil. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Every Wednesday at the Baton Rouge Star Hill Church, the Red Stick Market pulls up in their custom trailer, loaded with freshly harvested produce. We visited the market and heard from Pastor Reverend Raymond Jetson about just what this fresh food access has brought to his congregation and community.
First question I want to ask you, Reverend, is how long have you been here involved at the church?
Well, I've been the pastor here at Star Hill for what will soon be 20 years. But I've been a part of the church a lot longer. It is the church of my childhood, and I actually grew up four doors away from it. And so typically when people ask how long I've been at Star Hill, I'll tell them 57 years and 9 months because it's been a part of my life since birth.
And tell me, what are some of the changes that you have seen effect happen?
Probably the most profound is this recognition that we have a responsibility to address the persistent problems around us, that there are issues that impact the community, and it's actually our responsibility to begin to come up with innovative ways to respond to them and to actually allow people to see the stuff that we say in action.
Well, you know, that was one of the most inspirational things I ever read when I was reading up on you. It said that you had challenged your church to become spiritual entrepreneurs.
Yes.
So what is a spiritual entrepreneur?
We believe that spiritually we all have gifts.
We all have talents. We all have abilities. They're not the same. We're all different. And so how do we take what we describe as our God-given resources and use them in a way to make a difference in the world around us? The good news is that every one of us can be a spiritual entrepreneur. That
Absolutely.
It's not something for the spiritual elite, or it's not something for a select group, but everybody.
And it doesn't take any economic backing.
Doesn't take any of that.
It just needs to come out of your heart and soul.
You can be your own startup.
That's so inspirational. And this Red Stick Farmers Market is a relatively new effort, and it's one that you pioneered.
One of the areas that came out of a conversation some years ago was the absence of access to fresh foods in inner city neighborhoods. The description of the food desert.
Yes.
And we are smack in the middle of one. And the initial thought was around a nonprofit type of effort that would make food in a retail way available to people. And in one of the conversations, the question of, well, why couldn't the market be mobile and go to different stops within the food desert on a regular basis and make these wonderful products available, this produce available to people in the neighborhoods?
Well, you've timed it in such a beautiful way because you conduct a Bible study class here on Wednesdays from noon until 1 o'clock.
Right.
So that means everybody's thinking about what's for dinner, plus everybody's a little hungry, and there's no better way to get people to buy food than when that happens.
And it also gives me an opportunity to remind them that the market is there in very close proximity. And so it is good timing, but one of the things, and one of the evaluations for me, is the number of cars pulling up, because while we have a robust congregation here, we're not going to support the market and make it in the interest of the farmers to come back just on our own. Nor is this just to benefit our congregation. It's about making it accessible to the people of the neighborhood.
Well, as we drove up, approaching your church, approaching the market, I was really impressed by the number of signs that let me know the market was coming up and it was here. And you're doing a really good job with that on every level.
Thank you. We want to attract as much attention as we possibly can. I'm a recovering politician, and so I've always made use of signs and bumper stickers, and we make ample use of them still.
So in the time that the farmers market has been operating here, what sort of personal changes have you seen it affect within your own congregation?
There's a very practical, real-life case-in-point example. I was just talking to a young mother, and I would guess that she's in her late 20s. And she's walking over to that table, looking at the table, and the question that she shared with me is, I had to come and see, what was I going to cook this evening? And so she's looking at a table or tables filled with fresh vegetables.
Just harvested.
Just harvested, that she's going to make a couple of selections and take home and cook for her husband and for her two young children. Absent this, if it meant driving to a store or going somewhere else to have access to it, then I'm afraid that her family would end up with some less nutritious options. And so that's the most tangible option that I see. One of the things that we do is that because it's during the middle of the day, a lot of people work. They work far away. They can't get here in a timely manner. We allow people to place kind of a general order on Sundays, and we will pick it up for them today. We do a second Bible study on Wednesday evening, and they'll come in on Wednesday evening and pick up. And so it's really wonderful to see the bags prepared for people that they'll be picking up on Wednesday evening. So it's just increased the people actually eating the fresh vegetables.
Well, speaking of fresh vegetables, you've got the farmers and they're selling those already harvested vegetables. But I was really amazed when we drove up to the parking lot and I saw this very idyllic garden over there. Would you take us over to the garden and tell us a little bit about this particular effort of yours?
We have organized our spiritual entrepreneurs around various efforts that are intended to impact our community in positive ways. Last year, in partnership with the Capital Middle School, that is right behind us,
they planted their first garden. And then the group came and shared with me that their second garden, they wanted it to be on our grounds. It was near. We have ample green space. And so they wanted to plant their first. And they described this as their first small garden.
Their first small garden. Yeah, well, it's not that small.
But for them, they obviously have very grand plans. And so we said, go for it. And this is what happened. You have these rows of greens and squash and
I saw tomato. Yellow squash. Yep. I saw broccoli. I saw lima beans.
Yes, ma'am. And so let me tell you the absolutely wonderful part of this is that this evening, probably around starting about 3:30, 4 o'clock, cars will start pulling up and children will get out of them. And they will come and start working in the garden. Or you'll hear a child get out of the car and say, come on, I need to go do my homework so I can go to the garden.
Oh, that's fantastic.
And so it's not just an adult operation, but there's a wonderful group of kids who are now becoming gardeners. And, you know, they recognize that this wonderful stuff doesn't always come in a can or at a drive-through window.
Yeah.
And so it's really been invigorating. For the last Wednesday, last Sunday, we offer this to members of the congregation for a small donation so that we can replenish the garden. And it's really taken on an exciting life.
So, Reverend, for WRKF listeners, folks right here locally in the Baton Rouge area, how can they become involved, even if they're not a member of your Star Hill congregation?
Well, thank you for asking the question. I would say that virtually everything we do here is not about people who are just a part of our congregation. It's intentionally designed to reach and to invite in to the work people who are not a part of our congregation. And so for starters, we'd love if people would help share the news about the mobile market and its stop here on Wednesday between 12:30 and 1. And if once a month on a Wednesday, they could take their lunch and come by and support the market. Because after all, for the farmers, this is not a simply altruistic effort.
No, farmers need to make a living,
too. They need to make a living. They need to sell their crops so that they could get resources to gain more crops. And so anything that we can do to generate more customers and to be supportive of the farmers and their efforts, then that makes this a more viable stop for them. I mean, I have no illusions that they'll be here a year from now if there aren't any customers who are
right.
coming. And so if people could make a commitment to stop by once a month and to support the market, that would be of great help.
Well, thank you so much for sharing with us this incredible inspirational work you're doing, not just for your community, but really for all of Baton Rouge. And I hope you'll have us back when your projects grow into whatever the next level is.
We certainly will, and I thank you so much for sharing with us.
Pastor Raymond Jetson of Star Hill Church, growing some real Louisiana eats. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Next week, we travel to the Mote family's Progress Dairy and learn how to make classic Creole cream cheese.
There's a lot of transplants, actually, in the Jackson area since Katrina, and then when they find us, we know it, because they'll call us and they'll order like 10 to 15 Creole cream cheese. But the local people weren't quite as familiar with it, even though that was the last place it was made commercially.
Subscribe to our podcast, hear today's show, or catch up on previous editions anytime online at wwno.org and louisianaeatsradio.com. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Rouse's Markets, and Zatarain's.
Additional support provided by Dickie Brennan and Company and Linda Green, the Yakiman Ladies Soul Food Catering. Our media sponsor is Louisiana Life Magazine, the magazine of a great state. Original theme music by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Thanks to executive producer Thomas Walsh, consulting producer Margaret Howes, and sound engineers Guy Mulladew and Joe Schreiner. I'm Poppy Tooker. We'll see you next time. Louisiana Eats is a production of WWNO and the University of New Orleans.